Good morning.
Hello.
Hey. It's delightful to see all of you. We're going to be, this week we're starting 12 weeks. 12 weeks! 12 weeks is a manageable size. I feel like I can wrap my head around 12 weeks. We're going to spend 12 weeks in the Gospel according to Matthew. It's the first book of the New Testament, so it's not terribly tricky to find. There are blue Bibles, if you'd like to grab one. We have four Gospels preserved for us in Scripture. We have four accounts of Jesus' life. Last summer, we spent 12 weeks. 12 weeks is a manageable size. You can wrap your head around it. We spent 12 weeks in the Gospel according to Mark. And we had such a good time that, and not everyone was here for it. That, and if you're interested in listening to that, it is available online, thechapel@bellevue.com, or on iTunes. I know we are so hip and trendy and that we are on iTunes, but it is available online. Last summer, we spent 12 weeks in Mark, and so I thought we could spend 12 weeks in Matthew. Matthew shares a lot in common with Mark, like a lot in common. If you went through and you were to compare Matthew with Mark, you know, like if you were to you wanted to go like verse by verse or word by word, even like in the Greek, you know, in the original language, you would actually find 90% of Mark is actually like preserved and embedded inside of Matthew. Like it may have been like rearranged and there's stuff like, but like 90% of it is still there. Matthew's almost twice as long as Mark, but most of Mark is still there, interestingly enough. Sometimes it's been rearranged. Frequently, like, material has been added and stuffed in around it, but most of it's still there. It's like Mark is like a house, like a, you know, like a historic house. You know, you're driving through those neighborhoods and you find like a historic neighborhood. You find a quaint little house that you and your family want to live in, but it's not quite big enough for you and your family. It was like built in like 1800 or something. And like when they had, I don't know, when everybody wanted to live in like 300 square foot with no air conditioning or what, they wanted to. That's what they wanted to do back in the 1800s. Anyway, it's this small little house. And you guys have been in a house like this before that's been added onto. Somebody's moved in, and yet, but it's been a really good job. Someone's done a really good job of adding onto like a house or like a government building. Sometimes they do this too. You add on, and they're like seamless additions that start getting made to the house. The original house is kind of still there, but like I'm pretty sure that staircase wasn't originally there because the original building didn't have a second floor. Like all the trim work and the woodwork, it all looks really good and it matches. But like that's not quite original. It's been added on but it all kind of fits together seamlessly. The wood, the stone, the style, it all kind of fits together. The building's almost twice as big. And in the end, your little house, you've got to double it in size so your family can fit in it. And it feels like a lot different than it did maybe originally. But 90% of the original building's still there in one shape or another. I think that's what most scholars, in an image, that's what most scholars think is actually going on in the Gospel of Matthew. That's what's the relationship between Matthew and Mark, what we studied last summer. Matthew was there. He was following Jesus, and he's been following Jesus ever since. But as Matthew is getting older, he's wanting to like pass on. He's wanting to preserve. He's wanting to give to those around him. He's wanting to pass on the events and the teachings and the reality of what's happened in Jesus. And so this is what scholars guess. It's like he knows that Mark's account is kind of circulating out there. You know, people are passing around this story of Mark. But Matthew, he wants to emphasize things a little bit differently than Mark. He wants to, and so it's like He wants to accent things, emphasize, punch things, certain things a little differently than Mark. And so most scholars think that Matthew has used Mark's gospel as like his foundation. He's just renovated it. You know, he's added a staircase here and a second story there. It's twice as long, but most of it's still there. Last summer, we said that Mark is a bit like an action movie. That's what we said. That was one of the images that we used. That it's like The Matrix or Inception or something like that. A lot of action is happening, you know? It's like this loaded, like that scene in Inception when like the van's turning over and Joseph Gordon-Levitt is like running down the hallway. And it's like there's all this action happening here, but there are like layers to the action that's happening. You know what I mean? You're really having to like keep up because that scene, the hallway is spinning, but that's really about that the van is spinning, and that's really about another, you know what I mean? It's like, that's what the Gospel of Mark's a bit like. It's like this full of action and loaded, but there's layers. There's all kinds of like symbols and significance and meaning and depth to it. Matthew has renovated Mark's gospel, supplemented it. He's added to it to the point that it doesn't feel like an action movie anymore. It doesn't quite feel like an action movie. Matthew, the gospel according to Matthew, actually feels a bit more like The Social Network, or like The West Wing, or like a conversation on Breaking Bad. It's like a drama with like dynamite dialogue is more what the gospel of Matthew feels like. You guys have watched this before. You guys have seen TV. I don't know what your particular show is. That it's not like you like, though, TV shows and movies. It doesn't always have to have explosions or, you know, trucks flipping over. There are some times that you're watching, like, just a conversation between two people is so unbelievably compelling. It's so good. Like, you're just waiting for that character and that character, that other character. I cannot wait for them to show up in the same place at the same time and talk about that. Have that conversation. I can't wait for Hank and Walter to finally get in the same room and have a conversation. Breaking Bad, you guys really should watch it. If you were caught up in a TV show that's just got dynamite dialogue, if you were caught up in a TV show like that and someone was to yawn during that conversation, when are we going to get to some explosions? When's Bumblebee going to show up and start, you know, flipping over the highway? You'd probably think, like, did you just hear that conversation? That conversation is the explosion. That conversation had me more on the edge of my seat than any Transformers movie could ever have. Good grief. I thought we'd do show and tell this morning. This is actually an example of what I mean.
Everything all right? Let's get cracking.
I'm not here to rehearse, Dr. Logue. Call me Lionel.
Who are you?
Never. Called yourself Doctor. I did that. For you. No training, no diploma, no qualifications, just a great deal of nerve.
The Star Chamber Inquisition, is it?
You ask for trust and total equality.
Bertie, I heard you at Wembley. I was there. My son Laurie said, Dad, do you think you could help that poor man?
What, as a failed actor?
It's true. I'm not a doctor. And yes, I acted a bit. Well, I recited in pubs. I taught elocution in schools. When the Great War came, all our soldiers were returning to Australia from the front. A lot of them shell-shocked, unable to speak. Somebody said, Lionel, you're very good at all this speech stuff. Do you think you could possibly help these poor buggers? I did muscle therapy, exercises, relaxation, but I knew I had to go deeper. Those poor young blokes had cried out in fear. No one was listening to them. My job was to give them faith in their own voice and let them know that a friend was listening. That must ring a few bells with you, Bertie.
Give a very noble account of yourself.
Make inquiries. It's all true.
Inquiries have been made. You have no idea who I have breathing down my neck. I vouched for you, and you have no credentials.
But lots of success. I can't show you a certificate. There was no training then. Everything I know from experience, and that war was some experience. My plaque says L-lobe speech defects, not doctor. There are no letters after my name. Lock me in the tower.
I would, if I could.
On what charge?
Fraud. With war looming, you've saddled this nation with a voiceless king. You've destroyed the happiness of my family, all for the sake of ensnaring a star patient you couldn't possibly hope to assist. It'll be like mad King George III. It'll be mad King George the Stammerer, who let his people down so badly in their hour of need. What are you doing? Get up! You can't sit there! Get up!
Why not? It's a chair.
No, that is not a chair. That is St. Edward's chair.
People have carved their names on it.
Chair is the seat on which every king
is held
and queen...
by a large rock.
That is the stone of Scone. You are trivializing everything.
You trivialize... I don't care how many royal animals have sat.
Listen to me!
Chair.
Listen to me!
Listen to you by what right?
By divine right, if you must. I'm your king.
No, you're not. You told me so yourself. You said you didn't want it. Why should I waste my time listening
because
to you?
I have a right to be, and I have a voice!
Yes, you do. You have such perseverance, Bertie. You're the bravest man I know. You'll make a bloody good king.
There's no explosions. There's no trucks flipping over. There's nothing jumping out at you suddenly, like a thriller or something. And yet, by the end of 4 minutes, something within us is like on the edge of our seat, just because of dialogue, just two people talking. It's not like, you may not be physical, but like something within you is like wanting, you just want. Okay, you're picking up on the fact that this is like some sort of like important person and like, okay, King George VI, I want him to talk. Even if you've never seen the movie, like just within just a couple of minutes, you're like, this guy, he's having trouble getting words out and I want him to have a voice, because somewhere, even in the midst of just people having a conversation, it feels like there's more happening. There's more at stake than just this guy being able to talk. When he finally erupts, I have a voice! Something within us echoes, yes. Something within us just cries out, yes, yes, we want him to have a voice. We want him to speak. I think maybe dialogue, just a drama and dialogue, sometimes stirs something like this. It stirs something deep within us, maybe because we all want to have a voice, you know? Maybe that's part of what resonates with us, of like we empathize with somebody who isn't heard, who isn't, like nobody's listening or can hear him, and we want to be heard. We want people to know us. We want people to respect us. We want people to hear us, and we want to know and respect and listen to other people. Maybe there's something like that at the heart of like the power of the dialogue in a scene like that, but what maybe that's what conversation between a couple of characters stirs up within us. I don't exactly know. I just know it's a bloody powerful scene by the end of it. The best dialogue does that, though. Just talking. Characters talking back and forth. But the best dialogue, it invites us. It stirs us. It teaches us in some sort of way. It challenges us. Oh, I want something to happen. It challenges us to reimagine maybe what's possible. In a scene like that, you're like, yes, if he could speak, maybe my loved one could speak too. Maybe I could speak too. That's what the best dialogue does. It opens up a new possibility to us. A new world opens up in good dialogue. I think that's a bit what the Gospel of Matthew's like. Much of the material that shows up in Matthew, much of the material that Matthew has renovated Mark's story with is talking material. It's just talking. It's just teaching material. Jesus is a bit like an action hero in Mark's story. He's bursting onto the battlefield and just conquering evil, you know, trashing evil. As Jesus begins his ministry in the Gospel of Mark, if you were here, you'll remember it said that he did two things. He's announcing God's rule and reign, and he's casting out demons. Those are the two things that he's doing consistently in the Gospel of Mark. That's how Mark repeatedly, over and over, you read it. It's like announcing the kingdom, casting out evil. He's just proclaiming the kingdom of God, trashing evil. That's what Jesus does. He's an action hero who conquers evil. Matthew, on the other hand, at the very beginning of Jesus' ministry, it'll be up on the screen. This is the very beginning of Jesus' ministry in Matthew. Starting verse 23 of chapter 4, Jesus went throughout Galilee, teaching in their synagogues, proclaiming the kingdom, the good news of the kingdom, and healing every disease and sickness among the people. News about him spread all over Syria, and people brought to him all who were ill with various diseases, those suffering severe pain, and the demon-possessed, those having seizures, and the paralyzed, and he healed them. Large crowds from Galilee, the Decapolis, Jerusalem, Judea, and the region across the Jordan followed him. Now, when Jesus saw the crowds, he went up on a mountainside and sat down. His disciples came to him, and he began to teach them. The announcing of the kingdom is still there, the trashing of evil is still there, but there's a lot more that's been kind of added. The house is twice as big. There's a staircase there, and it wasn't there before. He sees all of the crowds, but then the disciples, those who want to learn from him, students, learners, that's all disciple means, they come out of the crowd to him. And then Matthew gives us three solid chapters of Jesus teaching, of Jesus talking. It's just dialogue, or monologue, really. These chapters, chapters 5 through 5, 6, and 7, have often been called the Sermon on the Mount. Perhaps you've heard of it. It's this block of teaching, and it's just the first of five blocks of teaching that Matthew gives us. I mean, there's a lot of talking that's been added to the Gospel of Matthew. In Matthew's story, Jesus is a speaker of words. He uses words a lot. He's a teacher. He talks a lot more. Matthew has a lot more dialogue, and the dialogue is dynamite. There is power in what is being said. I have a voice! It's powerful in that. There's something powerful in the words that Jesus gives us in the Gospel according to Matthew. And so I was thinking, where in the world do you even begin with Matthew's Gospel? And we're not at the beginning of the sermon. I'm very aware of that. We're not. But like on this first week, where do you begin with the Gospel of Matthew? Last summer, we spent 12 weeks trying to get like a feel, trying to get a flavor for Mark, trying to taste what, what does Mark taste like? And that was a bit of a stretch, because Mark's gospel is 16 chapters. Matthew's gospel is 28 chapters. The house is almost twice as big. Like, there's no way in 12 weeks that we're going to be able to explore, like, every nook and cranny of the house. And so my plan over the next 11 weeks is I just want to kind of dip into key sections of the Gospel of Matthew, some key, like, sections and stories in Matthew, especially some of the stuff that's only found in the Gospel of Matthew, and hopefully that's going to give us a feel, a taste for what Matthew, the whole of Matthew, give us a, kind of a shape of what the whole house looks like. Sound like a plan? Today, in the time we have left, I just want us to hear something that Jesus says towards the end of this first block of teaching. Like, we're kind of dipping in. Jesus is, like, gone up on this mountain, and his disciples are gathering around him. This is something that didn't happen in the Gospel of Mark. And he's teaching. And it's three solid chapters of him teaching. And I just want to hear something. It's only two verses. It's something that sounds very familiar, but they're verses that only show up in the gospel according to Matthew. Matthew's the only gospel writer who preserves these words from Jesus. And I think they're as good a gateway as any into the heart of his gospel. Verse 13 of chapter 7, enter through the narrow gate. For wide is the gate, and broad is the road that leads to destruction, and many enter through it. But small is the gate, and narrow the road that leads to life, and only a few find it. Narrow is the road that leads to true life. Small is the gate. But loaded into these words is something that it's unspoken. I just want to name it. It is possible. It is possible. Jesus is saying, small is the gate, narrow is the road, but I'm inviting you onto it. I'm inviting you to find it, to find life, to enter through something so small. I'm inviting you to walk something. It's difficult. It's narrow. But I'm inviting you onto it. It is possible. So many people miss it. They check. We don't have to be told this. Look around. Good grief. TMZ. Music television. You know, something. You know, I can't believe I just became the preacher who's talking about MTV. Look around at our culture. So many people are missing it. They're chasing all kinds of things, but they're missing out on real life. But Jesus is inviting us to find it. If we were to sum up what the gospel according to Matthew is, what the good news according to Matthew is, I think this passage right here, verses 13 and 14 of chapter 7, you could star them, underline them, that might be helpful. But I think this might be a key to what Matthew is all about. It might be a key to what the good news is, according to Matthew. All of the teaching and dynamite dialogue in Matthew wants to emphasize that the good news, according to Matthew, is good news of a narrow road. Good news of a narrow road. That sums up, maybe, the gospel according to Matthew. It seems a little counterintuitive, doesn't it? Seems a little, like, strange. We hear those words from Jesus about a narrow road. That doesn't sound like good news at all, does it? You read this passage initially, and I don't know. Some preachers, like, kind of relish making it sound like bad news, don't they? I've heard, growing up in church, it sounds like, oh man, you better toe the line, you better make sure that you're walking that narrow path, that straight and narrow path, because man, oh, God is going to get you if you don't, is what it sounds like, the way that, but if the passage is read that way, I don't know how it's gospel.
I don't quite know how it's good news. Makes me reevaluate the way that they're talking about it, the way that I'm the tone of voice that I'm reading into Jesus when I'm reading that passage. If it sounds like bad news, then it probably isn't Jesus. In reality, this passage might just summarize good news, according to Matthew, because Jesus is inviting us. This is what the whole of Matthew is about. This is where we begin in the Gospel of Matthew. Jesus is inviting us, not other people, not in another country, not in another century. Jesus, the living Jesus, is inviting us to a different path. He's inviting us to a different kind of life. He's inviting us to a different way of being human. There is a kind of life, Jesus seems to be saying, that really is life. It's true life. It is possible to find it. We can't, it's hard, it's difficult, it takes time and patience. It is narrow, but Jesus is calling us. He's calling us. Here, Northwest Denver, he's calling us onto a narrow road, and so God must make it possible for us to walk it. The call to a narrow road is extraordinarily difficult. I get that. That's what Matthew's getting at. This is difficult following Jesus, but it's also the best news imaginable. The narrow road is good news. Anyone who's practiced anything, anyone who's learned how to do anything can tell you this. You, yourself, you have experienced the narrow road being good news. Anyone who's ever practiced like swinging a baseball bat or swinging like a golf club, anyone who's practiced a swing on that has experienced the narrow road. You know, you don't do it like that. You don't hold it like that. You gotta. Anyone who's ever practiced learning a musical instrument or a new language or tried baking a dish, you know, knows about the narrow path. There is a narrow road. You need to hold the bat in a certain way. You need to hold the club in a certain way. You need to use particular... If you've ever learned to type on a keyboard on a computer, there's a narrow road. You use certain fingers for certain keys. You practice certain scales on a piano. That you do this because this is how you learn to play this instrument. The verb actually goes at the end of the sentence in German. I'm sorry, you can't do it any way you like. If you want to learn German, you have to put the verb at the end of the sentence. And the ingredients for that cake have to be put in this particular order. You have to crack the eggs this way, and you have to preheat the oven. Make sure you do it all in a certain order. Otherwise, the whole thing's going to collapse. Otherwise, it won't work. That's the narrow road. The narrow road isn't bad news. The narrow road is just the way things are in all of life. There are certain ways that things work and certain ways that things do not work. The narrow road isn't bad news. It's just the way things are. When somebody who can't hit a baseball to save their life, when somebody who can't, and if they were to go in and be instructed on how to, they would be instructed on the narrow road. They would be instructed on a batting practice, the narrow road of batting practice. And they would not say, I'm a bad example, but like whoever it is that can't swing a golf club is, and they're being put on the narrow road of swinging the golf club, they're not going to despair. They're not going to say, oh, what a wicked, evil, hard-hearted coach for putting me on this narrow road. What horrible news. Why are you being so awful to me? No. If you want to learn how to play golf, if you want to learn how to swing a baseball bat, you say, aha. Aha. What brilliantly good news. What good news. The narrow road is going to teach me how to play baseball. A road is going to teach me how to swing a bat. To switch the metaphor
really quickly. We've been talking about movies. We even showed a clip, show and tell. It was awesome. Remember that? Good times. We had good times. To switch the metaphor to movies for just a second, you can see the narrow road on full display if you watch the behind-the-scenes material of Lord of the Rings or The Hobbit. I don't know how many of you are nerds, but you like, I'll bring the rest of you with me on this. In all of those movies, if you watch like the behind-the-scenes material, all of the actors and stuntmen and performers have someone training them on how to move, how they're supposed to like move their arms and move their legs and hold their back and hold their head. In all of those movies, you have creatures, elves, dwarves, and orcs, all kinds of creatures coming to life on the screen. We've never seen any of these things before. We don't quite know how they're supposed to move. And so behind the scenes, if you watch these documentaries, there is a guy. They've hired a guy. A guy gets paid for this. A guy who's developing and designing and training people on how to move. He's literally showing like dozens and dozens of people, like, you're playing a dwarf, okay, and now you're playing an elf. Okay, well, you gotta move like this. You gotta move like this. You gotta hold yourself in this way. You gotta handle your sword in this way. You gotta handle your armor this way. You've almost got it. Try it again, try it again. He's going through, and dwarves and orcs and elves by the dozens are coming to him and learning how to move in a particular way. None of us have ever seen these creatures before. We don't know how they're supposed to move, and so he's showing them all how they're supposed to move. There's this guy teaching them, a dwarf moves like this. An elf moves like this. An orc moves like this. It is a narrow road. It is a narrow way. If you disregard what this guy says, sorry, you're not a part of the movie. If you want to be a part of this new world coming into existence on the screen, this is the way it looks. This is the way you move. And as we begin studying Matthew over the summer, slide two, Bob. As we begin studying Matthew over the summer, we begin here. Jesus has come to show us the way a human being moves. That's what Jesus has come to, that's what he's talking about. None of us quite, we've been born into this world, but none of us quite know how this strange creature called a human being is supposed to move. None of us quite know what it's supposed to look like. And Jesus brings us good news. Here is the way. A human being moves like this. It is a narrow road. It's a small gate. So many people are missing it. But I am inviting you. I'm inviting you to it. That's why we do anything we do as a church. And that's why we're studying the scripture. I just want to name that explicitly. We're wanting to come to Jesus and learn how to move. We're wanting to learn how to walk the narrow way from him. That's Matthew's goal for us. Not that we would gain trivia about Jesus. Not that we would gain more knowledge about history or first century Judaism or Greco-Roman culture or something like that. None of that is the goal. None of it is so that you can win more. I can feel good about teaching some trivial sort of thing or that you can win at Bible trivia. None of that is the goal. The entire goal of Matthew, he explicitly is making sure we know it, but the goal of anything we do as a church is that we would learn the true way of being human. That we would learn how we're to move as human beings. That we would become disciples, learners of Jesus. That's why Matthew writes his gospel. If the life of Jesus is not course correcting the way that we move in our lives throughout the week, if Jesus is not someone who's course correcting, showing us, guiding us on how to move during the week, we're fooling ourselves. We are fooling ourselves. It's a frequent theme
in the Gospel of Matthew. The people who are, there are all kinds of people who are interested in like religion or history or moral behavior. They're even Bible, little Bible scholars. They know all kinds of stuff. They're scribes and Pharisees. They know all kinds of stuff about the Bible, but they refuse to embrace Jesus. Like completely, totally. And that's who Jesus is warning the most strongly in the Gospel of Matthew. Fine religious people, moral people, who refuse to let Jesus reshape their lives completely. Until we are letting Jesus teach us how to move, we're missing it. We're fooling ourselves. We're missing out on true life. Until we really want Jesus. I don't know how to get at this other than to just say, until we want the living Jesus more deeply, more intimately than we want anything else in our lives, we are fooling ourselves. Fooling ourselves. Jesus is, he's come to teach us, to show us what it means to be human, what it means to bear the image of God. Okay, you want to be a human being? Well, you got to hold your soul this way. You got to handle your anger in this way. You got to handle your sexuality in this way. You've almost got it. You've almost got it. Try again. Try again. Jesus has come to show us what real life looks like. It's nothing close. It's nowhere even close to us saving ourselves. God, by his grace and Jesus, is always the one who saves us. That's what all of the Gospels are all about, is about God coming in Jesus to save us. But we are invited to participate in this salvation. We're invited to work out this salvation into our lives, to learn what it means to be a part of this new world that's coming into existence by God's grace. And that's something that Matthew doesn't want us to miss. He doesn't want us to fool ourselves, trick ourselves. As we're studying the Gospel of Matthew, the question is, are we fooling ourselves, or do we want to learn how to move from Jesus? Like anything of any value, it is a narrow road. May we not fool ourselves. May this study, may this series, may this summer be the season when we embrace Jesus, when we allow Jesus to embrace us. May we be haunted by the dialogue of Jesus, by the teachings, by the words of Jesus. And may his love and instruction and living presence teach us to move like him. Let's bow our heads and prepare our hearts for communion.